Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. This is Michael Silverblatt. And today my guest is Russell Banks, the author, most recently, of Cloud Splitter. This has been an amazing time for Russell Banks. The Sweet Hereafter was filmed this year, as was a previous novel, Affliction. The Rule of the Bone was widely embraced last year by school students around the country. He's the author as well of Success Stories and Continental Drift. And now this novel, which I believe is his, longest and, in fact, only really long novel, is Cloud Splitter from Harper Flamingo. And it is a life of John Brown as told by his son, Owen Brown. And I wanted to begin by asking you about the historical Owen Brown.
The historical Owen Brown was, in some ways, maybe in every way, he's the perfect narrator. He's the witness to all the events that that mattered to me in writing a novel based on the life of John Brown. And he escaped and never told about it. He escaped from Harper's Ferry and disappeared after Harper's Ferry into the abolitionist underground, which was probably like the Weather Underground of the 1960s and 70s, and reappeared on a mountaintop in Altadena, California, and lived the rest of his life as a hermit shepherd, and died without having given interviews or written memoirs, and left no real account of his experiences, which included, as an adult, work in the Underground Railroad with his father in the 1840s in Springfield, Mass., and upstate New York. Included the Kansas War in the 1850s, and culminated in the raid on Harper's Ferry in 1859. So he was the perfect witness. He was also his father's lieutenant, the closest of the many members of his family who were involved in the struggle against slavery, the closest to him personally, I think, and probably. In principle and morally as well. And yet he somehow escapes the gaze of historians. He's mentioned in more than passing ways by the biographers and the historians. But for some reason, there's very little detail and very little speculation about his role in his father's actions.
Now, I want to cut to the heart of the matter, in a sense. Here, it seems to me that no one has mentioned something that's of great interest to me, that teaching at Princeton, you are in a community with two other writers, Joyce Carol Oates and Toni Morrison, who've made racialism the center of a continuing investigation of American culture. It seems to me that the three of you come from very different backgrounds as artists, and arrive in Princeton not because of this shared exploration, but coincidentally, yes? And I wanted to ask you to try and define what the nature of the definition going on of race in America is in your work.
Well, I think all three of us feel each in his or her own way, that the story of race is the central narrative in the American story, that one can't tell even a portion of the American story without confronting it and dealing with it. The story of the relations, the war, what Owen Brown calls the war between the races, the ongoing, he says, ongoing war between the races, and he's saying that in 1900. One could say it in 1998 as well, the 400-year-long war. I think Tony and Joyce and I all feel that this is This is perhaps the central story of American history. There are many others, of course, braided in there, but this is one that we both, all three of us, feel compelled to try to tell again and in our own terms.
In your case, for instance, was this investigation of race a conscious pursuit, or was it, gee, I discovered that this is coming to the center of my novel practice?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the latter. I don't think it was at any point in my writing life a conscious decision or observation about the world that surrounded me that this was how I would work over 25 or 30 years. But somewhere along the line, I began to see that this was a central obsession of mine, and then began to try to understand why it was a central obsession. And I think that there are many reasons. Some of them have to do with my own childhood experiences, which don't have anything at all to do with race. I was well into adolescence before I ever had a conversation with a non-white person. I was raised in northern New England. But I think that from the beginning of my life, conscious life, I identified with the marginalized, whether it was due to class or simply family structure or family dynamics, better. This is perhaps true for Joyce as well, and certainly true for Tony. And that would lead a responsive white person, I think, to a sense of shared enterprise with other people who feel marginalized. And therefore, one would inevitably be led to try to tell the story, as I was saying, of the long ongoing war between the races from the white side, after all. I mean, in my case, and I think in Joyce's too, that's what we can tell most ably. And it's a side of a war that is rarely told. It's certainly the African-American writers from the beginning have realized the necessity to tell this story again and again. But white writers have shied away from it, have said, well, that's not a real story. In fact, if it is, it's over. The Civil War ended that story, didn't it? And that's the end of it. And then, therefore, they can think of someone like John Brown not as a hero, which is how most African-Americans view him, but rather as a madman.
Now, Owen Brown, John Brown's son, your narrator, I would say spends the first 100 or 120 pages of this book locating the language of white and black that he feels comfortable with. Mm-hmm. What is that like for you as a writer as well?
Well, that that struggle that he goes through for those 100, 120 pages, as you say, parallels and expresses my own attempt. I mean, that's certainly what I was trying to do too, knowing that I'm going to write a long historical novel that's going to try to squarely face this reality in our life from the most unconscious levels to the historical. I better find a language that will allow me to do that, especially because I'm writing in an environment, in a context that is so neurotically sensitive to the language of race.
I mean, because every word, all of the nomenclature here, there is, you know, even, you know, a word as, for its period, unstressed as Negro,
right,
becomes a charged word.
Right. Do you capitalize it or not, for
yes.
instance? Yes. And when do you use the word nigger? And when do you use the word black or African American or white or Caucasian or European? And do you capitalize those?
Now, I'm quite convinced that a lot of the readers of this novel are making a grave mistake. They're speaking, because the book is narrated by the son, as if the son is an unreliable narrator.
Yeah.
I don't think that's meant to be the question. The question is, how, in the light of this extraordinary father, does the son find what remains to his own character mm-hmm. to define himself?
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a matter of the tricky narrative subterfuge, but rather the question of a white man mm-hmm. in the wake of the father's campaigns to see what his own portion is.
No, he's not unreliable. He's a man who's telling the, I think, the absolute truth about everything that he knows. And he concedes he doesn't know everything. And I think because he's willing to concede, he doesn't know everything, that readers are sometimes thinking of him as an unreliable narrator. But it isn't as though he's withholding anything.
Yes, but I think that pointing of the finger and saying unreliable narrator is a way of critical evasion of the central issue of this book, which is what does the inheritor of the Civil War and of the racial questions make of them, and does he dare to write them down? This son remains silent for years and years and sequesters himself, and this is his coming forth, almost as if the book is the coming forth.
Exactly.
After years of, and years of a writer's ability to speak in this precinct at all.
Yeah, well, I think that this describes pretty much the history of modern American fiction by white writers for the most part. And then when we do enter into, generally, when we enter into the questions of race, with a few exceptions, and they're most noted, notable, Joyce Carol Oates is certainly one of them, then it turns out to be kind of appropriation, as in the case of, say, Nat Turner, Styron's Nat Turner or something, where that history is used for not as a subject, but rather as a background.
That's why it seems to me that John Brown is the perfect subject for you, because this is the white man who has dreams in the novel of being black, and so does his son. And one of the rare moments of complete bonding is when father and son acknowledge that they've both had these dreams.
Yeah, literal, physical dreams. He meant that in a very literal way, not fantasies or not hopes, but literal dreams. Owen says, "Did you ever dream that you were a black man?" And his father says, "Well, yes." And then they proceed to recount their dreams to each other and where they think the dreams come from.
And the young man feels grand.
Yes, that's right. He hadn't think of that moment. We are together, yes.
Yes. Now, this brings in that other question, the dream of this white self as the black man. There was the essay that Norman Mailer wrote, The White Negro. Right. And it seemed to me that that was in itself a kind of benchmark in this consideration. Is the white writer intruding into the subject, violating the subject, appropriating the subject? And how do you feel as the inheritor of those controversies?
Well, I think that the Mailer essay is a interesting way to begin the enterprise. I think it's a wrong-headed way, and it's kind of, now that we can look at it 40 years later.
40 years
it's
later.
It's much clearer to us that how the degree to which he's appropriating for his own self aggrandizement, really, identity of outsider, of hipster, in order to feel like himself an outsider and a hipster and not a bourgeois Jewish kid who went to Harvard. And we could see that in a way for the fuzziness that drives it, but that's okay. That's a place to start and to try to clear away some of that fuzziness and work with it, because he at least said, "Hey, look, this is a real fantasy. Let's not kid ourselves."
It was Lenny Bruce's fantasy as well,
right.
Unstated.
Yeah,
you know?
And it starts with us feeling as though we can't identify with our white brethren. That's, I think, the beginning point, to say, I can't identify with all these honkies. And so who can I identify with? Well, then who does a honky hate? And you turn and you look at this person next to you, and that's your first step emotionally. Towards identity, I think. And then the next step, I suppose, is to realize, wait a minute, that's illegitimate. That's simply morally not available to you. So then what have you got left? And Owen Brown tries to explore what he's got left. And on a strictly psychological and, I guess, familial sense, he says, I feel invisible except when my father looks upon me. And otherwise, he says, I am a man without race in a racialized society. And then he speaks of the loneliness that accompanies that. And that's where I was trying to get to, and not in any conscious way, and I didn't set out to get there, but that's where I got, I think, in this exploration was, okay, if you can't identify with – if you live in a racialized context, you cannot identify with your white brethren, and you have no moral right to identify with those your white brethren hate – then what does that mean? That means you are caught between the two poles of identity in a racialized society. And emotionally what that does is create a kind of loneliness, a kind of alienation that most Americans, white Americans, naturally are terrified of, that I'm terrified of.
Well, that's one of the audacious things in the book, that in addition to comparing John Brown, the father, to Emerson's representative men, Emerson's idea of what is the hero, now the son, you see, is being compared to Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man. And there is a real, it seems to me, bold swath being cut there. Did you feel nervous about creating the white Invisible Man?
Yes, honestly, naturally. After all, our discussions are literary representations of these questions are incredibly constricted and restrictive. And if you try to break out of those molds and out of those just lexical kind of chains that hold you, it's scary, yeah. And I did fear and do fear being seriously misread. Not because I think it'll hurt me in any personal way particularly, but that what I think I'm trying to do is worth doing. And if it's misread, then I won't have done it.
Mm.
Does
misinterpretation constitute failure?
If what I'm trying to do is to clear some ground and create a vocabulary by which white people can write about race more accurately and honestly than they have, yeah, then I would feel as though I had failed. And that is one of my attempts here.
So much comes into play of this book. The other simultaneous representation is that John Brown wants to appear in blackface and writes Sambo's advice.
Yeah.
And he is wanting to publish this, pretending to be an anonymous black writer in an emancipation newsletter.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, it's not published.
Yeah, they reject it. He's rejected by an editor.
And he's very disappointed as well.
Surprise.
At which point he becomes aware that his son Owen will have to be his voice. He recognizes that his impulse to speak in the voice of Sambo will not be an oratorical platform, that his son has a better instinct.
Yeah.
What is that instinct? Because it's the voice of this novel.
Yeah. Well, it's the private voice. Owen observes any number of times that father could say what he could not. He could speak in public. And he had a rhetorical flourish. He had a confidence and, well, he had charisma, what we call charisma, whereas Owen only has a private voice. He becomes his father's letter writer, his amanuensis in a way.
This is Michael Silverblatt talking to Russell Banks. Now tell me, do you think it's possible? So far, you've written books in which the white man is most at home with the black man. This is certainly true of Rule of the Bone. This is where the boy finds his voice and his fatherhood.
Mm-hmm.
In this book, too, the speaking figure is opposed to the violence and phobia against the black man.
Mm-hmm.
Could you, or could any white writer write a novel taking responsibility for the levels of fear and hatred?
Mr. Baldwin said that the true story of racism will be told only when it's told from the point of view of the white racist. And I think that's true for any kind of oppression that is participated in to such a wide degree, you know, that it's cultural or historical oppression. So it's pervasive, linguistic and every way in the society. And perhaps, you know, that is true. That's a story I certainly don't think I've told yet.
Well, it's a fascinating thing how little of it, in fact, ever gets told. Mm. One of the very few books I know is Gregor von Reszary's Memoirs of an Anti-Semite, and he's writing as someone of German extraction, at least. But
there's that story of Eudora Welty's about the shooting of Medgar Evers that's told from the point of view of the shooter.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember the title of it, but it's a brilliant tour de force. It's very brief. It does take you in a kind of clinical way into the head of the assassin, but it doesn't allow you to understand or appreciate or sympathize with the assassin or identify with the assassin and thereby implicate yourself.
And again, we're dealing with the special case, the man who is the assassin,
right,
as opposed to the common garden versions of everyday cultural self-generated.
In some way, Saul Bellow has tried to do this.
In a way, in Mr. Samler's Planet, but one feels so complex about the scenes. I guess that is the essence of it. Mm. Certainly no one's begun to define the problem, because I guess it's a problem that William Gass brings up. Can one study the reasons for racism without writing a racist book?
Mm-hmm.
There's a section called Being a Bigot in William Gass's The Tunnel that says pretty convincingly and chillingly how this formula is arrived at in a human being. But the book, as a result, dances in the most dangerous territory of all, a book that must be hated by everyone.
Yeah.
Tell me, if you can, what it is you know that allows you to be the spokesperson, the progenitor of these books, or that forces you to be?
That's a difficult question to answer, too. You ask some difficult questions here.
It's my job.
I think that it may be simply that I am suspicious of my own, I mean profoundly suspicious of my own abilities to keep from being created by my culture. I don't trust them, so I'm constantly examining them, and I'm constantly on guard against my culture's power to create me. And since I know my culture is a racist, sexist culture, I am obliged then to be very, very guarded in my dealings with it. And I think that slight paranoia that I have, we can even call it a moral paranoia, is one of the main tools that I employ in my writing, certainly, but I also in my daily life. I mean, as one as the other, I have to, as in my human relations. So, I mean, that's probably the best answer I can offer to the question.
Who, then, does a book address? Does it address, that is, as John Brown addresses the hated racist culture, or does it address that part of the culture that reads books and is willing to be informed? And is that part of the culture the equivalent of your garrisons in Cloud Splitter, the people who are educated but don't take action?
Well, I don't really have that clear and demographically determined sense of audience. I think that I wrote this book with the belief that that it was addressing me, that Owen is addressing me, that I am Catherine Mayo. I am the woman that he is writing to.
Yes. How did that name get chosen?
Catherine Mayo?
Uh-huh.
She is a real person.
Uh-huh.
Oswald Garrison Villard is the biographer, 1909 biographer of Brown, the grandson of William Lloyd Garrison. And his research assistant was Catherine Mayo, who later became a fairly well-known journalist in the 1920s and 30s. And she gathered the material for that biography.
It's just so strange, I must say, and I think it's an inadvertent strangeness, to be reading this book addressed to Miss Mayo on the subject of race and whiteness and blackness.
I know. It was too good. I couldn't let it go.
But if you are Miss Mayo, then who are you?
Mm-hmm.
Who is that?
Well, in this case, as I have found that in every novel I have written, and certainly as in the last half dozen or so, as I've gotten older and more conscious of what the procedures are, I've found that in order to invent a narrator or a speaker, I had to invent a listener.
Mm.
In order to control and create the parameters and the formats by which the narrator could speak, the rules and principles that would order the speech of the narrator. In this case, I had to invent, I came up with a Catherine Mayo, a research assistant in the East, someone who was earnestly trying to understand as much as possible whether or not John, the very simple question posed in the beginning, was John Brown mad or was he a hero or was he both, and to what degree? As he says at the beginning, I know you want to know this because this is the only question regarding John Brown worth asking and answering.
Now, my final question, we've spoken uncharacteristically for this program about a lot of political and sociological issues. And truly, your novels, especially of late, take up those issues. But they are also novels written with a writer's eye and ear. Is there an opposition between the aesthetics and the politics of a novel of this kind?
I'm unable to imagine an answer to the question, really, because for me, every sentence is a political act, for better or worse.
What does that mean, in fact?
It means that you cannot help but express your political position, your political vision of the world, which is to say your vision of power relations, in any sentence you write. The syntax, the diction, the inflection, intonation of a sentence establishes for a reader a presence that is political on the part of the writer. I can't imagine. So of course they are so they aren't separated from me. They're one thing. This writing is social behavior, and all social behavior has a political dimension. In fact, writing to me is the most social behavior of all because it's intimate interaction between strangers.
Thank you very much. I've been speaking to Russell Banks, the author most recently of Cloud Splitter. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Michael.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Jennifer Swadek. Special production assistance today from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in
books. Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Make you laugh and say, books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now with book, off the mouse, pop time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.